Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 55 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures, all that good stuff, coming to you from the beautiful gaming capital of the world where there's a chill in the air.
Indeed. It's definitely getting into winter time.
I know.
It's not good.
Stop. Winter time.
Oh, no.
Well, I give a little tease there as to what we're going to be talking about in this show.
Winter?
Well, no, stop it.
Oh, MC Hammer.
Because it's kind of our Hammer Time part two, right?
That's right. So, Cody, Hammer Overtime.
Tell everybody what we're going to be talking about in this episode.
Well, we are going to give the Warhammer 40K Assault on Blackreach introductory set a go-around. We picked up War Machine in the last year or so, and we're going to give our due diligence to the 800-pound dreadnought in the room and review...
The giant British gorilla.
That's right. We're going to give it due honor and tell you about the flavor of Warhammer 40,000. What? That was British spelling. I was throwing the U in
extra
there.
Vowels. You. It's a they're bonus vowels.
Maneuverer.
Exactly. So we're going to be talking about that and... it's kind of an all 40K episode because we're going to be talking about the beginnings of my Rogue Trader campaign.
Disastrous is not strong enough a word. No, I'm just kidding.
Whatever. but hey, also in sports, we always going to give a little sports update at the beginning here. The Colts, I guess by the time this episode drops, will have played the big bad guys of all of football, the New England Patriots.
Yeah, we'll have beaten the New England Patriots.
That's what I'm hoping.
Although Peyton Manning is no one to throw to. It's him and a bunch of corpses. And
how is... what is it, Tottenham Hotspur?
Oh, yeah, Tottenham Hotspur. They're doing okay. You know, they've the last match I saw, they won 4-2. So, come on, you Spurs.
Really? And we got a little bit of flack in the Game On Inbox recently about how we've not given any love at all to hockey. So, hey, how about that hockey?
Yeah, it's remarkable. Did you see the match?
Nope.
No, me neither.
Okay. You ready to get into this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, well, we're going to kick things off, as we always do, with some penance to our great sponsor. No, we're not. We're going to do something different. Going to change it up. And Cody, go. You go.
Thanks for that smooth segue. last episode, we had a contest about the Dragon Age RPG, the starter set for that, levels 1-5 in a box from Green Ronin. And we implored you, the listener, to write in and tell us why you should receive our review copy to spread the RPG gospel amongst your group.
And we got a lot of great entries.
We did.
A lot of very lengthy entries, which is a good thing. Really great stories about people wanting to play with their kids and wanting to start up new RPG groups and things like that. And we culled through all of them and read all of them, and we have our winner.
Yeah, we picked Corey Gerleman's entry. He's from Des Moines, Iowa. Beautiful Des Moines, Iowa.
Go Hawkeyes? Go Cyclones? No. Go something?
I don't know what's in Des Moines, but... Okay.
None of the major colleges in Iowa, apparently.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But anyway, Corey sent us a great email. We're going to post that on the Guild so you can read it, and I think he's going to have a good time. He's played the video game before, as a lot of the you listeners have, and I think he's going to have a lot of good spin on it. Now, if you didn't win... Don't be hating on Corey, because you can still get your copy. Either get it through your friendly local game store or our sponsor.
Oh, here it is.
Myriad Games. That's right. Myriad.
Nice tie-in.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you were going with that.
When we visited Myriad Games, I can attest their RPG selection is second to none. They really keep a well-stocked shelf. They've got several copies of almost every current RPG, and even some that aren't current, and even some that he shouldn't have copies of, like Rifts, because no store should carry that game.
Aww.
I'm just saying. But if you contact Myriad Dan, if you contact Myriad Games...
That's what we call him. Yeah. I'm just going to tell you, that's what we call him, Myriad Dan.
Myriad Dan and the staff will hook you up with the Dragon Age RPG box set. And if you're not going to get it there, get it from your friendly professional game store near you if you're lucky enough to have one. And let us know. Oh, and John wants to say something.
Oh, just one more thing about Myriad, because you know, we were always talking about the great game selection that they have there and all the bells and whistles that Myriad provides. But one thing that was really cool when I went there is that they have a whole section next to the RPGs that's like books for gamers. And I don't mean like RPG books. It's like fiction books that might be of interest to gamers. Oh, okay, yeah. It's not a huge section, but I was really impressed because I've been reading the Harry Dresden, the Dresden Files books.
And reading the Harry Dresden.
The Harry Dresden on the Facebook. And you know, I've been reading the Dresden Files series, and I've gotten through the first four books in the series. And when we went to Myriad, I noticed that he had like the first 12, no, there's like only 11 books. He had like all of them.
Myriad Dan bends time and space.
He brings out the books that aren't written yet.
That's right.
And so I picked up three more of those books while I was there. And it was really cool. They had just that series and just a lot of other fictional book series that might be of interest to gamers. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So Myriad Dan, he's got a great collection. Congrats, Corey. And hit up Myriad or one of your local stores if you didn't win.
All right, well, let's move on to games that we've been playing. So, Cody, what have you been playing the last couple weeks?
Played a few fun games. We've been playing, I mentioned we learned Volcano, the Ice House Pyramid game, and John is just excited about this conversation.
What?
Kaylin and I have been playing the crap out of this game. Uh-huh. It is, we've played several times, and it's kind of our go-to two-player game right now.
Well, hopefully, if the crap's out of the game, I might consider it again.
If the what?
You've played the crap out of it, maybe it might be worth playing now.
Wow, well done. Some other games, I managed to get a game of Talisman with all of the expansions that I own. I have everything up through the newest one, the Sacred Pool, which just came out. Huh. I had just finished painting all of my Talisman miniatures, so I wanted to kind of break them in and play a full game with all expansions and all optional rules.
Now, are all of these the Fantasy Flight versions of things, or do you have stuff that goes back a bit, or
no,
is it all the newer stuff?
No, this is all the revised 4th edition things. So
I'm just curious, for people who want to get into Talisman at this point, you know, what's available?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can... Fantasy Flight has produced 5 expansions and the base game, so you're pretty well set. And a lot of it overlaps ideas that were in the previous editions. The previous editions did have... You know, they had a dungeon expansion, and I think that's actually the only thing that overlaps. But I can see Fantasy Flight putting out like a city expansion sometime soon, or even a, God forbid, a Timescape expansion.
Fantasy Flight will always provide you with a path to retail enlightenment.
That's right, yeah. They will let you spend your money.
Yeah.
But we played that, and we played a 4-player game, again, with all optional rules and all expansions, and it was only 3 hours.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun.
Who won? Was it you?
No, our buddy Greg won.
Nice.
Yeah,
good job, Greg.
He pulled a come-from-behind win and shellacked us thoroughly. He seems to really enjoy it, so that was a lot of fun.
Cool.
Let's see. I played Crokinole for the first time.
Oh, what'd you think?
It was a lot of fun. The board was much bigger than I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I guess I thought it'd be smaller, but it was this huge honking board.
It's as big as Canada.
Almost, yes. My buddy Dare, he has one of the Helinski Crokinole boards.
Oh, the really nice ones.
Yeah, that's the one I want to get someday. But yeah, I mean, we played. I'm really bad at it,
mm-hmm.
And I'm usually pretty good at the dexterity games, but... this is something I can see picking up down the line. It's just one you can converse while you're playing it. You know, it's just fun, and you can play mini games in a row. And I really, really liked it. So
it has sort of that same feel of like a tumbling dice to me, as far as just a quick dexterity thing that you can just pull out anytime, mm-hmm. and have it available.
And it looks really cool on a wall.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I didn't even think about hanging it up. That'd be pretty cool.
While I was there, I played two other games that were a first time for me. The first one was called Magical Athlete, which I believe is a game that Z-Man picked up from some sort of small distributor or small designer. And it's a game where it uses a draft mechanic to pick which racers you're going to pick. So it has all of these kind of supernatural and fantasy, mythical like creatures and classes and people. And you're going to run 4 races, and you get points for if you finish first or second in each race. And so you're drafting your team of the 4 of the 4 runners that's going to be on your team. So, you know, there's stuff from, you know, a bard to vampires and ghouls and all sorts of weird stuff. And they all have kind of a special power. So you'll get a starting amount of money. I don't want to go into the rules too much here.
No, it's fine.
But, you know,
I'm interested.
I know. You'll use that to draft your team. And then for each race, you'll secretly pick which racer you want to send out. And then, you know, their special power activates. What it is, basically, it's just a roll and move. I mean, it's kind of, you know, on your turn, you roll a D6 and you move your guy that many spaces. And I think, you know, there's 40 spaces for one race. But, you know, you'll have, you know, I had the Amazon for one race, and her power is instead of rolling the die, you can just move forward 5 spaces.
Oh.
You know, so I would just do that. Or, you know, you have the Ghoul, which I think is if someone rolls a 1, they don't move and you move forward 1 space.
Oh, I see.
It's
a little bit more in depth than just a pure roll and
move. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Modify things.
There's a lot more to it. But it was a surprisingly fun game. It was very kitschy. The art was very interesting. But
is it Japanese?
Yeah, it seems like it.
Because that name just sort of sounds like you know.
Magical Athlete.
Super number one best magical athlete.
Yeah, the whole thing looked very Japanese, you know, okay. Very Japanimation sort of thing. But it was a lot of fun. I'd like to play it a few more times, but... It was an interesting game, to be sure.
Cool.
I also got to play Pony Express for the first time.
Oh, I want to say that's the same designers as Dice Town.
I think so.
Awesome. Definitely the same kind of theme, right?
Yeah. It was a really fun game. It was out there. I've never really played a game like it. It combines a roll and move with Liar's Dice with. I would say, like, you know, like a dexterity element to it.
Heard you have to like flick the die across the board.
Yeah,
or something?
you can either get in gunfights with people to where you each get on a corner of the board and you flick your like you have a little the meeples are basically like wooden cowboys.
Oh, okay.
And so you place your guy on a showdown space and you're trying to flick your dice and knock him off, you know, as part of a shootout. Or you can, in a very un-PC way, there's 3 little red Indian wooden tokens, and you have to flick your die and try to knock over as many Indians as you can. I'm not even kidding. Yeah. You can play poker in it because it uses the same dice as Dice Town. And you can, there's a really interesting element. There are certain spaces that have a little beer mug on them where if you land on that, you have to take everyone's drink order. You have to get up and then fulfill the drink order. And you can be really specific about it. You know, in the game you know, we played, I've heard of people like ordering, you know, make me a White Russian. You know, they make a White Russian, they bring it back.
Like a real drink? Like you leave the table and go and make a drink?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, you get up and, like, you know, I had Kaylin go get me a glass of water from the bathroom. Like, oh, you go to the sink and give me some. Yeah, I just made her walk to the other side of the house and get it. And then you come back and you roll a die and that's... And you then have to pay for the drinks.
Oh, wow. That's yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, but it's got all of these... It's this really mishmash of elements that makes for a really fun game.
Huh, cool.
So Pony Express, I think that's one I want to take another look at.
It's, oh, I got to check that
out. I'd really like to play it again. But that is the glut of what I've been playing. What have you been playing?
A little bit less than that, actually. I'm trying to think about what exactly has been preventing me from playing much lately. I guess I've been trying to focus on learning the rules to Warhammer 40,000, which we're going to talk about in a second. So that was the majority of what Cody and I have played together in the last week or two. You know, one thing that I began a foray into this past week that I've never really done before so much is a video game. I actually went and purchased Civilization V.
There you go.
And I had Civilization 3 back when it first came out, but I mean, I have never been a video game person at all, especially not PC video games. I just found like I get kind of bored with them, I guess.
Yeah.
But this particular version of Civilization, it's almost like it's kind of dummy proof, and I'm a big dummy to test it on, as far as it being able to kind of guide you and tell you what you need to do on your turn. You still have lots of choices, but it's going to tell you.
You have your advisors.
Yeah, and it's going to, you know, it's going to push you in a particular direction. You don't have to go the direction the advisors tell you, but it'll ask you, you know, what production do you want to do in this city, or what research do you want to do, and you can make those decisions. And actually, it started my American campaign. Got to start with a good old George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a pretty good job so far of destroying Greece, which is nice. And
sorry, Greek listeners. Well, we bear you no ill will.
My favorite part is that I'm down the AI computer, you know, Greece player had three big cities, three big areas, and I basically raised two of them. Or I think I put up a puppet government in one and then raised the other one. And then I went to and clicked on the city of Athens, their capital city, and it brings up the screen where you see like the cool graphic of the leader, you know, talking mm-hmm. to you. And his response after I've completely destroyed the cities is, "What, are you tired of fighting?" Like, really? So the AI there, not so great.
No. So are the Americans your favorite Civ to play so far?
Well, I played the demo beforehand, and I played Greece, and I played a little bit of Egypt. And I guess I don't have an opinion yet. I need to play a few more games to really figure it out. But it's a really great game. And
England's cool.
Is it? Okay.
Nice naval power.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So I'm going to have to explore that one a whole lot more. It's definitely a time suck as far as you can sit down and then you look up at the clock. And
Have you had to pull yourself away?
A little bit.
One more turn mentality?
Well, and this was made worse by the fact that this past weekend I actually threw my back out at the gym.
Ooh.
And so I've been sort of out of commission for the last few days and have just had to sit in a nice reclined position, which, you know, is nice in my leather recliner with the laptop on my lap playing Civilization. So it's, you know, real easy to play a little bit too long. So.
And the board game just came out, did it not? I think it came out today is what
I'm hearing. Yeah, right around now. And one thing that's interesting is I didn't, you have Civ 5 too, right?
Yes.
You got it through Steam, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I bought an actual,
physical version
of it, right?
Nice job, Grandpa.
Well, it's because I had some reward zone points for Best Buy, so I got a discount on it. But I got it home and I opened it up, and on the back of the rule book is an advertisement for the Fantasy Flight board game.
Good for them.
Yeah, yeah. Very so they nice. Really linked up with Firaxis and the people that are making the video games. So.
I'm very interested to try the board game out to see if it's, you know, a replacement for Through the Ages or if it's anything like it. I've heard it's got a lot of Rune Wars elements to it.
Really?
Yeah, just kind of like exploring the map as you go along and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. I don't know.
Well, you know, since Cody and I have both been, you know, into the video game, we will definitely at least game share the board game and bring you guys a review of it because it looks real interesting. Mm-hmm. Other than that, one other game that I played with my wife. I haven't had an opportunity to play too many games with Rachel lately. She's actually starting up a photography business, and so she's been doing a whole lot of stuff with photography. And
a darn fine one, I might.
Thank you very much. I will.
You had nothing to do.
I will tell her you said that. I helped her pick out the camera. That was
fantastic.
But so she's been real busy with that. But we had a chance to play a board game that I had ordered from Myriad that's been out for a few years now called Thebes.
Oh, I'm sorry. My pyramids aren't good enough for you, but you can do Thebes.
I played the pyramid game, though. Don't be judging the Thebes game until you
play
it.
Sorry, I feel like I have to strike back. I really like the pyramids.
All right, that's fine.
Jeez.
Be retaliatory.
That's fine.
Well, we played Thebes or Jenseits von Theben, which is the German name for
it. That sounds exciting.
This was a pipe down. I will mute your channel. It's a game that was actually nominated for the Spiel des Jahres a couple of years ago. And it's a game about doing archaeological digs.
And ooh. So,
okay, all right, okay. Your point has been made. And in the game, you're going to be moving around the board to get research, specific kinds of research, so that you can go and do these archaeological digs. So the research is represented just by cards. There's either general research, which can be represent any of the colors of the on the board, or a specific research, which is for a specific location. Once you've accumulated research, you can then move your pawn to one of the locations to do a dig, and you can do a archaeological dig. And this is where the mechanic becomes very, very cool, because you have to decide how much time you want to take to do the archaeological dig combined with the amount of research that you've done. So if you've got like five pieces of research, then each player gets this sort of... It's called a time wheel. It's like this little...
Wheel of time.
So, yeah. It's a little interlocking wheel thing with a little window on it, and you'll line up and say, here's how much research I have. And then you can make a decision as to how long you want to make the dig. Everything in the game costs time. So if you ever played the game Red November, which that's another game that uses the same kind of time mechanic. So you could say, I'm going to spend 6 weeks... doing this dig. So then you just kind of look in the window and you say, I've got five pieces of research, 6 weeks that I'm working on it, and then that'll mean four. So, and four is the number of tokens that you'll pull out of this bag. And so you have one bag for each color. And in the bags is like half of the tokens have good stuff on them, like artifacts that are worth points. The other half is just blanks, like debris that's not worth anything. So you'll pull that number of tokens, you'll keep the stuff that's good, and any of the debris goes back in the bag.
Oh.
So it just gets worse and worse as the game goes on, as far as, you know. And so that you have to build up more research so you can get more pulls out of the bags to be able to have a higher percentage shot of getting the...
It sounds okay. I could get behind that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's... I think that the cool thing, and the thing that's kind of difficult to explain on the radio here, is that...
on the radio.
On the internet.
On your FM dial.
Is the time mechanic. The fact that you will take an action on your turn, but it's variable as to how many weeks you're going to take to do that. Then you'll move your pawn on that board, and as long as your pawn is the last one, then you can continue taking turns. Whoever's in last place, time-wise, will take the next turn. So it might be that if you're, like in a two-player game especially, if someone takes 8 weeks to do something, and now you're like, you know, 10 weeks behind them, you could possibly do two or three small actions, you know, before you even get to where, you know, you cross over to their pawn, and then it's their turn. So that's a really interesting element of the game, is to, you know, how you can sort of leverage that and make your decisions based upon getting extra turns.
You know, you tried some pyramid games, so I think I will try Thebes.
Okay. And I gotta say, I'm just kind of half joking about the pyramid games, because I finally have found a style of game that I don't particularly care for, and it's taken me a long time. It did not take you a long time to discover multiple kinds of games that you don't care for.
And then there are multiple kinds that I love.
Okay. See? And that's what makes the world go round. That's what makes this the best podcast that we're doing right now.
It's a small world after all.
Yep. In this particular room in Indianapolis, Indiana, this is the best podcast that's going on.
Maybe.
So that's pretty much what I've been playing.
I think you've left off one thing.
Okay.
One thing we both played, and that is your Rogue Trader game.
Oh, yeah. That's right, yeah. So, we want to talk about that.
Let's talk about it.
All right. So, listeners, we've talked about this for several episodes now. It seems like it's been like 50-some episodes.
Yeah.
That I have endeavored to be a GM in my first role-playing game adventure. And I have begun my Rogue Trader campaign.
He did. We got together. We did character creation, ship creation, and a short intro to the adventure. So tell us about it.
All right. Well, so what do you want to know? Just in general about...
The listeners want to know about your prep here.
My prep. Okay. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean to... That was...
Jeez.
Yeah. Anyway.
We're professional podcasters.
Well, as far as how I prepared for it, I have to admit that I was using a pre-made adventure from the Rogue Trader book.
As you should.
And yeah, I've actually heard in both directions on that. As some people have said, if you're new, definitely go with the intro adventure because, you know, it kind of gives you some guidelines for things. And I've heard the other way too, where, you know, using that kind of hamstrings you, and that it's better to make up your own thing because otherwise, you know, you'll have your face in the book the entire time.
No. No.
Well, and I didn't find that to be the case.
Yeah.
I mean, and there was some elements that I was reading and, you know, that I was kind of looking down at the book, but in general, I think I was able to, you know, tell this overall story without doing that so much.
I think you did fine.
Thank you. So, you know, as far as prep goes, I just, you know, kind of took the NPCs that I knew were going to be in that part of the adventure and just kind of wrote down their stats and had them on a sheet of paper so that I would have them, you know, right in front of me. And I guess I didn't really write too many notes on the adventure itself because, well, a lot of it was already written in the book there. But I just had sort of an idea in my mind of what I wanted to say. And maybe, like you had mentioned, just had some ideas of how people might respond and, you know, some... not canned responses, but just some ideas of if they do this, here's maybe the direction I want to go with
right.
that. So, and I did find that I had to change a couple of things on the fly, which was kind of interesting. One thing in particular is that in this, well, let's see, I don't really want to necessarily give away the adventure in case you listeners happen to want to run it at some point, but we'll just say generically that there was a situation where a whole bunch of information could have been acquired if there had been an astropath in the party, and then it just so happened that the four players that are playing they didn't choose an astropath, nor did they take any sort of NPC astropath with them on this.
Frank,
Frank the astropath. They found one later on the ship. They created Frank the astropath, but And so they could have gotten a lot of information right up front about kind of a mystery if they had had the astropath there, but they didn't. And so I had to figure out a way to relay that information to them because it was important. And we got later and later in the adventure and I'm like, oh, they need to figure out. So I basically had this one character just sort of start expounding upon and reasoning things out like it was the end of Murder, She Wrote or something, you know, like, well, you know, Miss Fletcher, I want to put all these pieces together. And, you know, and I think it worked out okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'll kick it to you because you actually played in the game. Cody had a very cool character, Sergeant Vic Decker.
Yes.
The arch-militant.
Yeah, I'm basically playing just every, you know, Arlie Ermey, you know, drill instructor stereotype.
Yeah.
You know.
Outstanding.
You know, it's a response to everything.
All right.
No, it was, I'm going to give him props here. I'm not one to blow smoke up people's butts, but,
he's definitely not.
No, but John did a fantastic job,
especially
for a first time. It was,
thank you.
It was phenomenal. I mean, I think you're a natural. You got to keep doing this after this campaign, try other ones. I think you got a good fit for it.
I will. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. We had, it was just really well done. The system is, I thought it was going to be really basic at first, but there's a lot of depth in there because it's all based around a percentile-based system, you know, where it's just D100, get your target number below. But there's a lot of stuff going on there. And so I have a copy of the book. I'm going to be trying to mine some more of that out. But everyone's really excited. You know, Kaylin is really excited. You know, she was looking. She didn't know how much she'd like the dark sci-fi kind of thing of it, but she's having a blast. She's our rogue trader.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So everyone in the group seems to really be digging it, and John's doing a good job. So
let me ask you this.
Yeah.
If you could give me one piece of advice, either, you know, or some constructive criticism on something that I know is my first time, and you've been very gracious about, you know, saying I did a good job, but there's anything you could just give me as a big hint or a tip of, you know, something I could improve on or just try next time or, you know, work on, what would it be?
Don't necessarily look for, rules, answers. Like feel free to make a call on the fly unless it's a really critical thing. You know, if it's someone's like, is the range on my gun 80 or 100? You know, it's like break for the player, or, you know, if it's a damage thing, just kind of, you know, give what you feel is a good number, but just keep it going there.
Okay.
I know you want to, you know, have the rules right, and that's fine. But, you know, it's all those things. It's good to, I always have like a sheet of paper or something. I always write down, you know, any questions that come up. Because even in my 4E game, and I ran that for a year or two, I know that system really well.
Mm-hmm.
After every single session, there'd be at least one thing where I didn't know, you know, some weird rule quirk. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't know what the right answer was. So I'd make a ruling there and then just jot it down and research it and find it out later.
Oh, that's a really good idea.
Yeah. And then at the beginning of the next session, or at the end of that session, if you want, you can find it out and then kind of report back to the players like, all right, I checked this out and it looks like, you know, that gun's really 100 meter range. So we'll use that going forward, just so you know.
That is the nice thing about role-playing games, and I know that probably the reason why I did that is because I'm such a board gamer, is that if you have a particular rule and it gets played wrong over and over again in the experience of a board game, well, then you get to the end and it really affects the outcome.
Yeah,
it can break the game. It's like, oh, that, you know, that weapon actually was supposed to hit on a 3+ instead of a 4+. Well, you know, then that really could have impacted the game. In a role-playing game, there is a lot more flexibility with that. And, you know, one thing with the combat, we had like one little sort of mini combat thing in the middle. And I just sort of found that the rules for Rogue Trader don't list a whole lot. It's not like fourth edition where there's very specific rules about line of sight and distance and that kind of stuff. It's a lot more fluid. But I sort of found, I don't know what your opinion was of this, that it was almost a little bit too fluid. I would almost prefer a little bit more, you know, if someone says they're going to move, I need to be able to tell them, here's how far you can move, mm-hmm. and not be guessing at it so much, because I felt like I was just sort of guessing at a lot of the abstract, you know, of the combat.
Yeah, and that's where you can tighten it up and you can make it a little more tactical if you want in that regard. That's a lot how the earlier editions of D&D were, you know, because with third edition onward, they made the you know, the battle mat, the battle grid was almost essential. In fourth edition, it absolutely is essential. Third edition, you might be able to get away without it. But in like first and second edition, when I learned, it was you could use miniatures in a map, or you couldn't, and it would be just the same. It was all about that. How much tactical play did you want? in the role-playing game. So Rogue Trader seems a lot like that. You can play it very abstractly, or you can you say, okay, you have, you know, your speed is, your movement's 42. I'll say you can move four squares and then do something. Yeah, I mean, it's all about how you want to do the system. I know some systems where they're, and I think Warhammer 3rd Edition is like this, where the ranges aren't even numbers. It's just, you know, melee, close, and far.
Yeah,
and stuff like that.
Tokens between the little stand-up cardboard things, yeah.
So it's you're running the game, so that's the cool thing is you get to call your shots there.
Yeah, and that is really cool looking forward in the adventure. You know, I kind of know how it's spelled out, but I feel a lot more freedom in the next session to be able to not stick so closely to the book. I mean, I want to get to the same basic conclusion that the book gets to, but I feel a little bit more confident about if someone comes up with some crazy idea and wants to go do something, I don't feel like it's going to come off the rails. You know, I feel like I can find a way to, I gained a lot of confidence by doing this first session.
Yeah, you did great. So, it was fun.
All right. So anyway, we'll keep you posted on the progression of the Rogue Trader campaign. We're not sure how many sessions we're going to do. I mean, this particular adventure might take another two or three sessions, you know, depending on how much we want to add into it, but we'll see where it goes from there. So Rogue Trader, good game.
Indeed. All right, we're going a little old school. We're kind of going in the old familiar pattern
of the show. The game rundown, then the email, right?
So, but don't get complacent, listeners.
That's right. We could throw something crazy at you at any moment.
That's right. We do have a few emails that we wanted to discuss with y'all. The first one is James Burns, and he writes he has one of his favorite moments during LARPs.
Oh, outstanding.
Yeah. He said his was during a World of Darkness vampire LARP where he spent almost the entire game session talking about philosophy and religion while in character. He didn't have any interest in the power gamers or the plot of the LARP. He just liked role playing. He says at the time he was going to college and studying Eastern religion, so it was useful to know his stuff. And he thought it was neat because, you know, you could discuss these things while in, you know, being another character and doing that. And that kind of brought a lot of memories back for me because I remember a lot of people would do that. You know, they maybe weren't going to play characters that were worried about making a power play or, you know, fighting all the time. They just wanted that kind of theatrical experience and to share that with people. So that's pretty cool.
Now, because I don't have any experience with LARPs. If you're someone who he says he's not interested in the power gamers or the plot of the LARP, I mean, would that ever cause a problem to not be interested in the plot of the LARP? I know that if I was sitting around my Rogue Trader campaign and there's someone who's just sitting there and they're not interested in the plot, not taking anything away from James here. I'm just saying that in a tabletop game, if you're not interested in the plot, then that would screw the game up. Is that different in a LARP?
Well, the thing is, it's a just different volume. I mean, in your Rogue Trader game, you have four people. A LARP, you've got 20 to 30 minimum.
Oh, so who cares if one guy is
exactly? Yeah, I mean, you'll have. And I remember, you know, almost every session was like this. You know, there's every night would have some sort of kind of climax to it, and you know, the majority of the people would be, you know, at that site. You know, you'd have 20 PCs that were there, or whatever, and then there would always be people, you know, back at the warehouse just kind of sitting and talking all the time,
having a drink.
Yeah, so you know, in a LARP it doesn't quite matter cuz you can then, you know, pick your pony, pick the plots you like, and you know, if it looks like it's going to be a combat, you know, or a real fighting oriented plot, you stay away from it. I played a very non-violent, very physically weak character. Mm-hmm. That, you know, abhorred violence. So, you know, anytime I found out, oh, it's going to be, you know, or I kind of looked like it was going to be a plot where we're going to go in and take down some werewolves or something, I would stay far away from that and go do something else.
Okay.
All right. We have an email from Glenn Taylor, and he says,
Hi, Glenn.
And he says, good day, gentlemen. He mentioned that he liked the episode where we talk about our experiences at Myriad Games and the fact that if you listen to our show and then the D6 Generations episode that was released right around then, you get a lot of like two sides of the same coin, especially with the BSG game where I airlocked Craig Gallant's character.
Oh yeah, that was it is very funny to hear their side of that. So.
he was not pleased.
Yeah. Oh, just as an aside, I mean, we talk about those guys a lot, but got to give props to the D6 Generation podcast for maybe new listeners of our show. They're another show that does really similar stuff to us and has just a really great, very long, but yeah. A really, really great show. And we definitely encourage you to check them out. They're just great guys and gals, and we've enjoyed playing with them. So.
That's right. You can go to our website, and there's a D6 Generation link.
Yes, there is.
See, look how nice we are.
Yep, we're very nice.
But anyway, Glenn goes on to write, he asks to get our thoughts on Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is the big box role-playing extravaganza rolled out last year by Fantasy Flight. This one has really caught my attention. It's at the top of my Christmas wish list, even though I haven't played a role-playing game since high school, and that was a long time ago. From what I'm reading, the role-playing community is really divided on this. The old guard seems to be really put off by the components and the glittery bits that come with the game. The main criticism seems to be that this is nothing more than a board game in disguise. Ooh. Others, like myself, are really captivated by the components, but also the innovative systems like the dice pool, the party card, the stance system, and other things. Love to hear a review. Thanks again. And Glenn was also the one who asked that we talk about hockey more often.
He's from Vancouver.
Whoa, is that a Vancouver accent you just did there?
No, that's probably a...
Vancouver!
probably a New England accent, actually.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry, we got one accent on this show. But thanks for the email, Glenn. Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition was going to be your pony of choice for running an RPG.
It was.
And you bought it.
I did buy it. I do still have a copy of it. And I demoed it at Gen Con with Jay Little, the designer, and it was a great demo, and we had a lot of fun with it. And it looks like a really fun system. It just looks like, for me as a first-time GM, way too complex. I like the... And so, I mean, I'm not going to give you really a review here because I haven't played a full campaign or anything. But based upon this demo, it's a very rich experience because you've got these dice pools that are very detailed. And so you can really... come across very specific details of how something happens. And it's good for storytelling. But you have to have a GM that is really good at interpreting that and doing it relatively quickly. And I think that's the problem that I notice is that, you build your dice pool. And so I just say, hey, I want to climb up the stairs and jump off the balcony and swing from the chandelier and land on the bad guy. That you can do that all with one dice roll in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. But, then building that dice pool takes a few minutes, and then you roll it, and then you have to interpret it, and the GM might be able to craft a very cool story element out of it, but it just seems a little bit clunky to me. It seems like it'd take a really long time to get that to be fluid. Because, for example, in contracts, Rogue Trader, if you had something like that, that might be two skill checks, they're percental, you figure out your degrees of success, that takes, no time at all, and then the GM gives a story. I mean,
I've heard that the interpretation is really cool that you can, say, oh, well, since you got that die, that's a complication, then this happens. But I've heard that getting that dice pool together and then doing the, kind of dividing everything out really takes time. It's almost like Descent-like at times, You're rolling all these dice and figuring it out. My opinion of it, I've not played it. I've kind of flipped through it a little bit. I don't mind all of the tokens and bits. I think if I were having a group go through it, I would pick and choose. I wouldn't necessarily use all of the bits that come with it just because I think that can distract from what it is and take away from the role-playing a little bit because you're just kind of anchored into all of these bits and how to track things. I think some of it can be helpful, and it certainly looks neat. But I've heard good things. I've heard bad things. Don't listen to the grognards who are saying, oh, it's not real role-playing. It's all these bits. Ignore it. Have fun.
The lines for things are getting so blended these days between role-playing experiences and board game experiences. And I think that's a cool thing. We've talked about blending of, Euro game and American game mechanics and dice in interesting ways, all that kind of stuff. I think it's a really cool product. And I think that they're even are moving, probably because of the backlash, are moving to a place where you can just buy the books and actually play the game without all of the cards and bits and that kind of stuff. So, that might be another option too if your group was really against all the little bits and everything. I think the components are really, really cool. And if you can get it under your fingers and your brain, then it can be really, really cool. It just seems like the learning curve for it would be pretty steep. And you just have to get people that have a lot of buy-in to it for an extended amount of time.
Yeah.
To me, it's really no different from a Descent, Road to Legend, or Sea of Blood campaign. It's almost that level of component complexity. And you just got to have people that are willing to sit down and learn all of that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for writing, Glenn.
Yeah, and you know, if you ever get it and run a campaign of it and have a review for us, we'd love to hear it. So
yeah, I'd be real interested to hear kind of a hands-on view of it.
Yeah, because I mean, just it was really cool to just hear the get the demo at Gen Con, but to actually hear about a campaign would be very, very cool. All right, so we have one more email that we want to read for you here, and it is from Adam Helbling.
Infernal Jewelry.
What?
Helbling.
Oh, that's nice.
Thank you.
I need to get me some hell bling. Anyway, he's from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Oh, no. Live free or die.
And I'm not just making up the accent there. He actually wrote that in his email as M-A-N-C-H-E-S-T-A-H. So
there you go.
There you go. And he says, Cody and John, I'm a fairly new listener to your podcast, but quickly become a huge fan. You guys touch on all things of gaming that interest me and the group of friends that I play with. He said, you may or may not remember meeting me at Manchester, New Hampshire last month. I was in there looking for a new game to play, and you guys suggested I take a look at Alien Frontiers, which I ended up purchasing fresh out of the shipping box.
Cha-ching!
We definitely remember you, Adam. Absolutely. And it's really good to meet you. And he says, now down to business. My question is for you guys is, what recommendations do you guys have for a successful tournament system for a group of regular players? My reason for asking is that my regular group has been playing a points-based two-week cycle tournament. We get together every 2 weeks and play for about 6 to 8 hours. Points are given based on the position you finish in each game played within that 6 to 8 hours. Our first go at this is coming to a close this upcoming weekend, and we've even gone so far as to have a trophy. And we will have a cake in celebration.
Sweet.
Celebratory cake is always a good thing.
The cake is not a lie.
Yeah. this trophy will be given to the first place player after this week's final session and at the end of each 10-event rotation. Do you guys have any recommendations on how to modify or enhance this tournament experience? One idea I'd like to enforce in our next installation... what's the word you use here?
Instance.
It's too many syllables for me. Sorry. A certain percentage of the game should be new games, and a larger percentage should be games we have played before. This adds a certain dynamic to the experience. And Cody, what do you think? I mean, I haven't even really thought about tournaments for a game group. What do you think about that?
If I had a regular board gaming group, which, you know, it's like I have a group that, you know, we do RPGs and stuff. I kind of wish I had a regular, you know, four or five person board game group. That'd be really cool. This something like this has always intrigued me, you know, doing like seasons, you know, it's like, well, tracking, you know, how well you do. Give it a little extra oomph.
Yeah.
It sounds like you already do something I would suggest in the points per placement. You know, it's like first place gets, you know, 5 points, second place gets 3, third place gets 2, last place gets 0 or whatever. Mm-hmm. A couple things I would suggest is have something that brings game time on an equal footing. So where, you know, say you have a 1 hour game and, you know, you award points based on that, but then you have a four hour game, you know, should it have the same point, you know, payouts as a 1 hour game or something smaller?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you may consider, you know, some sort of multiplier for the bigger games if you want to weigh the bigger games more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just something to think about there. And the only other thing I could think of, you were talking about, you know, deciding which games to do. Why not have that in a draft format where, you know, you determine some sort of way, you know, say the last place person of your first season gets to, you know, pick the first game in the list, and then, you know, and have certain criteria that have to be met. It's like, all right, we need, you know, four games that can be played in 2 hours or less. We need four games that are, you know, 4 hour mega games,
mm-hmm.
you know, certain genres, however you want to do that, but then do it draft style. And, you know, there's a little bit of strategy in that too. So,
yeah, that's a good idea. I think you need to have a group that are very flexible in what they play.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, if you got a big stack of games and someone says, we're going to do this one, and you get three people going, I don't really like that game. You know, you have to kind of deal with all the, you have to have some social contracts in place, I think.
Sounds like he's got a winner of a group, though.
Sounds like it, yeah. Yeah, but
I would play Euro games if there was like this tournament format. That's pretty cool.
And a
cup.
I could maybe put that together.
I think we should.
Now, what do you think about different numbers of players? So would you need to change your point distribution for like a five player game versus like a two player game?
I would say in that, I don't know how many people are in his group, but you know, I'd almost say you get four people and you
stick to four player
stick
games.
To four. Yeah.
Okay.
Or yeah, up to four. I mean, I don't know, that would be the hard thing to kind of you know, really adjudicate. But
yeah, but that's a really cool idea.
I want to do something like
that. No, actually really sounds interesting to me, because that's something that I've wanted too. Is, you know, Cody and I get together and play all kinds of things, and we sometimes get together with his friends and sometimes a couple of guys from my work, you know, but we don't really have a regular board gaming group, you know, and that's something that would really interest me, probably even more so than you. It'd be to have a regular group of guys and gals to play board games. So that might
the Game On Cup.
That might bring some people in there. Yeah. So yeah. So Adam, thanks so much for your email, and keep on gaming and living free and not dying. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps up our inbox. Oh wait, we got one more thing. You know what we got this episode?
We got a voicemail.
We got a voicemail, and it's from Keith in Decatur, Illinois. Keith, take it away.
Hey, Cody and John, this is Keith from Central Illinois, Decatur. I was just listening to episode 53 on diplomacy, and I will say that I haven't listened to episode 54 in case there were other comments, or really I haven't checked the forums on BGG since I was waiting to be surprised at how it ended for you. The thing that occurred to me about your problem with the hurt feelings this time also applied to me and some students that I ran the game with at school. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you allow there to be a tie. When you allow for the event of a tie happening in the game, then what happens is people will assume that you won't get stabbed in the back. As opposed to if there's being one winner, then everybody knows that everybody at some point is going to try and make a move to be the sole one. But it sounds like the three of you had what sounded like a really good pact, and the three of you were going to take it to the end and be co-winners and all be excited about that. And the problem became that when you guys decided to change those plans, he was hurt by those feelings. So, I don't know, I think that the same thing happened to us, that when there was the tie, there was a lot more hurt feelings because you felt like there wasn't any way to get in on that alliance if it was so tight. There was no crack. You couldn't go to either you, John, or you, Cody, and try and work out something against the other one because you guys were playing for the tie. And I think that might be what caused the hurt feelings there. So just some food for thought, and look forward to hearing some more about the games as you go forward. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you, Keith, for your voicemail. He brings up some good points.
Yeah.
You know, I checked, and, you know, it's like by the book, you know, if more than one person wins, it's considered a draw.
A draw, yeah.
Yeah. So that may be a good reason.
That the only thing that makes that really tough is that we played for like 8 or 9 hours, and we still had only eliminated one person. I don't know how you can – I guess you just have to have people that have played a long time and can play in a lot more of a cutthroat manner because
–
you know, I just, the game would just take 20 hours to get, you know, get to a single winner.
Yeah, I think we're at the point now where if we don't pick up any new players, if everyone in our group is someone who's played before, that maybe we do the tournament timings, which is even, isn't that much faster, but it's, you have to have your orders written by the end of the phase instead of doing a 15-minute phase and then a 5-minute order writing phase and then a 5 to 10 minute, you know, a resolution phase. You do everything then. Well, I mean, you do it and then you resolve it.
Oh, I see.
And then you immediately move into the next season.
Oh, so that would mean that if everybody got all their stuff worked out and turned all their orders in the first 6 minutes, then that would speed the game up by almost 20 minutes right there. So, oh, okay, that's a good idea.
Because I think we're all getting to the point, even if we picked up maybe one new player,
yeah,
you know, I think we could get things up to speed pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that we did that I think – it kind of is along those lines, but then it played out kind of strange, is we did have that trophy for the winner, and it ended up, you know, being shared by by me and Ryan, and yeah, so I think if we could keep it to a single winner, that would be pretty good.
Right.
Yeah, we really appreciate all the emails and voicemails we're getting about this diplomacy game. It seems like it's of great interest to a lot of people.
Very popular.
Yeah, which is great, because I think we'll really be able to tweak it and make it even better next year. So thanks for all the feedback.
A fine-tuned machine.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of machines, John.
Oh, let's hear it.
You know, I got nothing.
There's lots of large machines in the Warhammer 40,000 universe, which is what we're about to talk about.
Nicely done.
All All right, so we brought out, as you can hear, the MC Hammer music again, which means that it's once again Hammer time.
Oh boy. We're going to spend our money poorly.
You thought that had gone into the archives, but no, we brought it back out again. We spent our money poorly. That's funny. You know, as you know, listeners who have listened for a long time, you know, you've been on this journey with us.
A sojourn,
if you will. We're board gamers. We're role-playing gamers. We've never really been involved in miniatures wargaming. And we are all about broadening the gamer's horizons, being a well-rounded common gamer. And so, you know, a year or so ago, we got into War Machine. We learned that. We brought you on that journey with us. And so we figured the next step would be to take a game like Warhammer 40K, which has such a following. And
almost like a sacred cow of gaming, really.
It kind of is,
It's like you always see it played in a game store.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things. It's like, that's 40K. I could never get involved in that. I could never learn that.
Or you always will hear like dyed-in-the-wool gamers that are in like their 40s saying, oh yeah, back when I was a teenager, I played a lot of 40K. You know, it's always on the resume of the big-time gamers. Right. Oh, I played 2nd edition D&D. And oh yeah, I played some, I had an army for, you know, 40K. I played some Space Marines. And so, you know, we're a little late to the game on this one, but, you know, and I think you've said before, we've kind of almost made fun of
gamers. I would make fun of minis gamers, you know, spending all that money on miniatures.
Yeah. But we're getting a better understanding of the whole thing. And so I've traded a listener to the show, actually, a board game for the Assault on Blackreach set that he hadn't really put together yet. And so I put together all the miniatures and didn't paint them. So, you know, say that up front.
That's fine.
Didn't get them painted. But we just wanted to see what the game was like and if we wanted to continue pursuing it at all. Space Marines versus Orcs is what's in the Assault on the Blackreach set. And we're just going to tell you about it. And also, one of the main goals here is to bring you sort of the new miniatures gamer's perspective and also to compare Warhammer 40K with War Machine a little bit, because there's a lot of similarities and a lot of differences between those two games, and just sort of give you our impressions.
It's interesting because it's like you never hear about the new 40K player. You know, it seems like every 40K player you know has been doing it for 10, 20 years.
Yeah, that's true. Even going to game stores, you never hear the guy saying, I just got into it like a month ago.
Yeah.
So that's going to be us, though. So Warhammer 40,000 was designed in 1987 by Rick Priestley and Andy Chambers.
I was 4 years old.
You're four. I was 11. Yeah. And it was designed by Game, and you know, produced by Games Workshop. Still is produced by Games Workshop. It is a it has sort of a sister or brother game, Warhammer Fantasy Battles, which is set in the Warhammer Fantasy universe, and it's I don't know anything about that game, so I can't even speak as to whether it's anything like 4K, 40K, or different. But you know, it's another one produced by Games Workshop. With a similar sort of mythology, I guess. So for the 40K universe, as we mentioned in previous shows, is sort of this grim, far future where there's lots of war and just billions upon billions of people and different races and things. And so there's a whole bunch of factions in the game. I think it's like, you know, 11 or 12 different factions that you can play. And, you know, the whole idea, much like any other miniatures game, is that you set up your miniatures on one side against another player and you go at one another. And there might be objectives to claim or territories you have to take, or, you know, like a capture the flag kind of a thing. Or you can just play a game where you play a certain number of rounds and whoever has defeated the most points worth of figures will be the winner. So that's sort of the basics there. So the way that the game is produced is in sort of squads of miniatures. This game is very heavy on infantry, you know, whereas like War Machine is kind of a low model count sort of squad based game. This you have squads, but they're much larger.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I played the orcs in the game that we played, and the one of the kind of things you can play is called the Orc Boys, B-O-Y-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And this mob of Orc Boys is 20 miniatures, and which is just huge. You would never find anything that big in War Machine. And, you know, so there's a larger model count, and they're also all plastic models.
Yeah.
I think they make some individual solo figures in metal, but that's pretty rare.
I thought I was going to hate the mostly all plastic thing. I think I like that better
kind of
early on, putting a point in 40K's category.
Yeah, I didn't like the at first that it's so they're so light. They feel more like little toys.
They feel cheap.
And cheap, yeah. But if you look at them though, the detail on these Games Workshop miniatures is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how, you know, they really would be a lot of fun to paint. I've painted up like one of the Space Marines in my set just to see what it was like, and it was actually real easy to paint. So, and I'm not sure how it would be to do, you know, 15 of them at a time, but, you know, take that for what you will. But, so in the game, you're going to be, you know, setting up on one side of the table and the other person's on the other side. And then there's just sort of a turn order here. And you have a movement phase where all your characters and your figures are going to move. You're going to have a shooting phase, which anything that has a ballistic weapon that you can shoot has the opportunity to shoot. And then you'll have an assault phase where you'll have kind of your close combat. And there's actually some movement involved in close combat as well. And so, you know, what you'll basically do on your turn to start off is that you're going to have... well, let me back up just for a second, because the way that you sort of build your army in this is based upon points. So a particular squad of Space Marines or something like that is going to have a certain point value, and then you're just going to kind of add those up, and you decide ahead of time what kind of a point value you want in your game.
Yeah, it's a lot like War Machine, except for the big difference is, whereas in War Machine or Hordes, you have a Warcaster or some sort of, you know, general or captain of your army that if they go down, you lose, and everything kind of flows from them. It's different for Warhammer. You just kind of build what you have. You know, there are solo figures and captains and things like that, but, you know, if they're killed, that doesn't ruin your day, and all the power of that army doesn't flow necessarily through that character.
Right. It much more feels like a big army battle of some kind, just, you know, setting
the... And like John said, a lot more infantry.
Yeah. So the way it's packaged is in these different sets of squads, and, you know, depending on what faction you're playing, it could be a squad has, you know, five figures or could have 20 figures in it. And they come in like a plastic box on these sprues. You have to cut them out and, you know, chop them off the sprues and assemble them and glue them and all that kind of stuff. All the stuff that goes along with the hobby element of a miniatures war game, it's all there. And it's there extensively, too. I mean, as far as the, you know, painting, if you want painting tips, there's, you know, book after book on Warhammer 40,000 painting tips. There's even a magazine, White Dwarf, which is devoted basically to the Games Workshop hobby, and, you know, you can get painting tips and things for that. The company sells this whole Citadel line of paints. I think they even have like a giant, it's like a giant complete paint set or something.
Yeah, it's this mega paint set. I want to get one of these someday.
Uh-huh.
It has every paint and wash and foundation that they do. It comes with brushes and it has terrain. It's basically everything you need to paint. And, you know, it's like $250. It's really expensive.
Wow.
But it's one of those, you get it and, well, you're pretty much set. You just have to replace individual pots.
Yeah.
But they're out to make some cash. Not a bad thing. But.
Yeah, yeah. So the Assault and Black Reach set has armies that are about 400 to 500 points on either side, whereas a typical game that you would come to the table with, a 1,500-point game is a pretty typical game. That's going to be actually a lot of figures, depending on what you're playing. So anyway, you're going to start off with this movement phase, and movement is kind of cool in this game because it's very simple. All infantry move 6 inches. That's it. Like in War Machine... You know, if you're cards with all your stuff on it, and that, you know, and they have their speeds, and they're all different. 6 inches for all infantry. That's just how. The only thing that would be different is if you were in like difficult terrain, if you're going to be going through like a forest or over hills or something like that. You would roll 2d6, and then you would take, if you're going to go through that difficult terrain, and then you'll take the highest value, and that's the number of inches that you'll be able to move. So that's pretty simple. There's rules for vehicles and things like that. You know, there's jet bikes, and there's tanks, and I mean, there's just a whole array of things here. It's just a huge, huge universe worth of products.
No.
And so there's special rules for those as to how they can move. But, you know, you'll move all your figures, and then you have your shooting phase where you have anything that can shoot. You're going to look for line of sight to see if you can see the figures that you want to shoot at. And then you'll, of course, measure your distance, your range, to see if you are actually going to hit them or not. Line of sight rules in this game are very cool because they're very similar to the game HeroScape, which
they're the best kind of line of sight rules.
Which is, I mean, and given the when these games came out, it's probably more like the HeroScape rules are patterned after the 40K rules, and that's like true line of sight. So, can you explain how that works?
Yeah, instead of one of the things that gets me about War Machine sometimes is that how you can trace line of sight, you can be really kind of chintzy about it. It's like, well, technically I have this one unobstructed straight line, so I have full line of sight, or however you want to work that, which is lame. This is where you get down on eye level with the model. So say you have a Space Marine. Can I see that orc? You take that model off, and you look, you know, where the Space Marine would be looking, and if you can see enough of the orc, then you see him. If you don't, you don't.
Right.
And it's one of those things where I think it's easy to adjudicate. It's easy to get a third party. You know, if there's a disagreement among the two, you can bring in third and they can look and make
them
call.
Kneel down and look. And,
yeah. I mean, it just makes a ton of sense and it doesn't feel cheap to me.
Right.
I just really like that.
Right. Other things are kind of abstracted, like distance and range. If you have a unit, all the units are going to kind of fire at the same time. So if I have a whole mob of orc boys that want to shoot their orc sluggas guns, which will be highly ineffective guns, by the way, you just have to measure from the front of your... You have to measure each of the shooters and make sure that they can reach at least the front of the unit that they're shooting at. So you don't have to like pinpoint and say... Orc number one is going to shoot at Space Marine number two, and you know it's more. So that's kind of abstracted. Also, wounds are a bit abstracted too. We'll talk about that in a second. But when you have to take casualties off the board, you know you don't have to necessarily take the ones that you know were being. You're not going to specify what to shoot at, so you're not going to really specify what gets killed.
It comes off very fluid, though. I mean, yeah. it doesn't seem like they're just cutting corners. It's all for faster gameplay, and you get the same result, really, in the end.
Yeah, and the rule book has some good, you know, kind of thematic explanations for things like that about, you know, in a real battle, everybody be kind of jockeying for position and moving out of the way, and there'd be a lot more actual movement going on than there is in this, you know, static board. So you do your shooting, and the shooting, let me just back up for a second. Each one of your model units is going to have a stat line of some sort. This is where this is very different from War Machine in that, well, it's not different because War Machine has a stat line too, but War Machine has cards. So every figure or unit is going to have a card, whereas Warhammer 40,000, they don't have any, there's no cards.
Right.
It's just basically you have a book and you have, you know, a chart that has all of the different stat lines. And from what I've heard talking to people in game stores is that after a while, you just learn your model's stats. You just know them cold.
Yeah, well, heck, by the end of our game, we were starting to memorize some of our more heavily used troops, like just the Space Marines. I was starting to memorize their stats. So.
Yeah, but I kind of knew with my Orc Death Copters that they're going to hit on a five, you know. And mm-hmm. I did sort of notice that, you know, as you play, you sort of learn that. But in the beginning, though, you might be sitting down with some charts and some cheat sheets and things like that.
Oh, definitely.
And so, you know, every character in the game is going to have like a line of different. Statistics that go along with their particular all the different models. So you have things like weapon skill, which is the ability to fight with a melee weapon, ballistic skill, you have strength and toughness, you have, you know, your number of wounds and initiative values, but you know every character is basically boiled down to a line of, you know, like 9 or 10 numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a whole lot of like special super special abilities. You know, there might be some spells. When you start getting into like psychers and things like that, again, it's a big world. We're just scratching the surface.
In our game, there wasn't.
Right. You know, and so it's a lot more straightforward as far as what you're going to do. So if you want to shoot a weapon, when you get to the shooting phase, you're just going to roll a 1d6 for each of the guys that's going to be shooting. So if you have a group of like 20 people that's shooting, you're rolling 20 dice.
Yeah, the dice can really get heavy in this game.
Yeah, and you're going to take the strength of your weapon, and based upon that strength, the ballistic skill of your weapon, you're going to have to roll a certain value. And it's sort of like a the higher the value of the ballistic skill, the lower you need to roll in order to hit. So it might be 2+, 3+, whatever. So you'll roll all those dice, and then you'll score a certain number of hits. And then at that point, then you're going to determine whether those hits are going to do any damage. This should sound familiar. It sounds kind of War Machine-like. You know, so then you're going to take anything that's a hit, those dice, and you're going to re-roll those. You're going to take the strength of the weapon that you're shooting with, and then you're going to compare that with the toughness of the figure that you're shooting. And there's a chart in there that says what you need to hit, what you need to get in order to wound based upon that comparison. And then that'll be a certain number of wounds. But that's where it doesn't... In War Machine, that's where it would sort of end, right? You know, then you would just deal your damage, right? In Warhammer 40K, you have an extra step called saves. And you might have things like an armor save where you have, you know, armor that you're wearing or, you know, that will grant you some protection. Or you might be in cover. You might be behind something that's going to grant you some cover. And so then you're going to be able to possibly roll some dice to save from getting wounded. And so you'll just sort of determine whether you are granted a particular save.
Which one you want to take.
Which one you want to take, because if you have like multiple saves, you have to you can only take one. There's even some called invulnerable saves, which basically it's like a save that you always get, even if you have other saves that might fail. And then you'll roll those dice to determine which of those wounds might have gotten negated or saved. And then anything that's left over, you're going to remove your casualties. A large number of these troops only have one wound, so they're going to come off the battlefield immediately. Some of the larger ones, like Space Marine Terminators and stuff like that, might have two, so you can put a marker there showing that it's wounded. And that's kind of how that works. So you'll do that step, and then you're going to have what's called your close combat or your assault phase. And assault is your close combat, your melee, but it also might include some movement. So you can move into assault up to 6 inches. There's a whole set of rules as to how you're going to kind of, if you have a mob of orcs and then just going up against some space marines, that you're going to kind of push in and sort of all kind of line up behind them. You can sort of think about it as, the mob attacks and you're just trying to get in there and everybody's trying to get as close as they can to get those melee weapons.
It's like when you're watching a battle in a movie and, they finally just get to so close, they just run into the first enemy they see and just start hitting on it. That's what I didn't grasp this phase at first in the game. It felt really weird, and then I kind of visualized that. You're watching Braveheart, and eventually they just kind of run into each other with no form of tactics, and that's what this is.
Right. And so you're going to kind of butt up your troops against one another, and anybody who's in contact, in base-to-base combat contact, is going to be able to fight. And then whoever is basically within 2 inches of those that are in base-to-base combat are also going to be able to fight. So you might end up with a large number that are going to be able to fight. But in the assault phase, both units are going to get an opportunity to fight at the same time. So it's not just like if I attack his Cody's Space Marines, it's not like he's just in a defensive posture. He'll actually get to attack me too. And that's where the initiative number comes in. And so based upon your initiative number, we'll determine who's going to be able to attack first. And you're also going to get bonuses if you initiate the assault. Then you're going to get an extra hit. Also, if you happen to have more than one weapon that you're holding, like you might have a gun and a sword or something like that, then you're going to get an additional hit for additional attack for that. So, you got 15 orcs coming in and they get 3 attacks each. It's 45 dice. I mean, buckets of dice in this game, really. And so a faction like the orcs, that's really what they're trying to do, is they suck at ranged combat. They really have bad ballistic skills and really terrible weapons for shooting. But if you get them in there for melee combat, they can really overwhelm their opponents sometimes just by sheer numbers. And so it's just sort of a similar resolution there, where you're going to roll and do hits and then do damage and then do saves and then remove your casualties. And there's also rules for things like morale checks. If you lose a certain number of troops, this is very similar to War Machine, then you have to roll for a morale save. And if you fail it, then you basically run off the board. And those are kind of the basics of the game. You're going to finish up those three phases, the movement, shooting, and assault phase, and then the next player will get to do their three, and you'll just continue on a certain number of turns until your victory conditions are met. There's a lot more to this game than what I just described, and a lot of it is driven by the particular models, and when you get particular models with particular weapons, if you look at an orc model, what it's holding, determines what it does. I mean, it's not like it's just sort of some generic
or an artistic choice.
Yeah. I mean, if it's holding a chainsword, then it has a chainsword, which means it can do what a chainsword does. And so that's kind of new for me, being sort of a board gamer and not being able to sort of mod out my models for games like that. So. So that's the overall real high-level overview of 40K. And, what did you think of the game, Cody?
My first impression when we were done was that it was much more different from War Machine than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Again, I don't really have a lot of miniatures games knowledge, and I had just learned War Machine when we learned it, a year or so ago. But I thought War Machine would be a closer riff off of 40K, and they're actually pretty different. Yeah. Miniatures games, there's some similarities, but they feel much different when they play. Mm-hmm. And the game was not as nearly as complex as I thought it was. There's a lot of charts and kind of looking that up. And yeah, there's a lot of dice rolling, but I think this is an easier game to pick up than War Machine as far as just ease of rules.
I think so too, although I'm sure we're probably going to get 15 emails now saying, oh, no, there's no way. This is what we're coming. But, you know, I agree with you.
Yeah.
The basic rules.
Yeah, I also liked it a lot more than I thought it was. I didn't think I was going to like it. And, you know, had I played, you know, my first impressions, I like this a little better than War Machine. Obviously, I need to play more 40K. I've played a ton of War Machine and a little bit of 40K. Mm-hmm. So it may just be, you know, I don't know if you can call it Cult of the New if it came out in 1987, but it's new to me.
Cult of the New to you. Yeah.
That's right. But it was a really fun game. And probably my biggest thing I like about it is that it doesn't have the Warcaster element to it. Because that's the thing I really don't like about War Machine is that, you know, with kind of the cheesy line of sight things, if you can get one good shot in on my guy, well, that can ruin everything.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I like more of a tactical, you know, control point or just, you know, kill them all sort of a thing without having to worry. You know, it feels like a chess game when you're playing War Machine. It's like, oh, did I leave my king open? You know, I prefer just to make it more squad based and, you know, take military objectives like that.
That's a really good point, and it's almost like Warhammer 40K might do a better job of storytelling, in that, you know, it feels like this epic sort of army battle. You know, one of the things that happened in our game was I have these three death copters, these little helicopter things, and Cody has a dreadnought, which is this giant vehicle, big walker vehicle, you know, and I was able to take it out in one shot with a rocket launcher. And we looked up the rules for how you calculate damage on vehicles, which we didn't even really get into. But and we went through all the different steps of the attack, and we rolled the final die for damage, and it said it was destroyed. And there was like a pause, and Cody said, I think we might have missed a step. And we went back through it, and no, we sure didn't. That's the way it worked. But, you know, it gave that sort of cinematic feel of, you know, this lucky shot from this rocket launcher just happened to pierce the armor at the right point and just blew it up. You know?
No.
Whereas, you know, War Machine really does feel like, I almost feel like it was sort of like, it's almost like Magic the Gathering a little bit. That because you sort of, you know, you can play Magic the Gathering of, I got all these creatures, you know, creature, and then we'll just duke it out and just send them and, you know, match up the creatures and fight like that. But then you've got that deck that is the red deck that's dealing direct damage to your wizard, you know, to the player every time, you know, then what are you going to do? That's what War Machine feels like, I think.
Yeah. And something in War Machine's credit, I could see if you played a lot of 40K, especially, you know, against a certain faction or something, that it could really feel very samey. You know, just everything's, you know, Space Marines don't really change that much. Where I could see War Machine being a little different just because you have all the different Warcasters and they have spells and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I could see that. But one other strength I thought about with 40K is, you know, even by the end of our game, we were moving quicker than we do in a War Machine game. Yeah. I mean, we were really just, you know, we were starting to memorize our charts and you know, just the turn seemed to go quicker.
It seemed like there was a less brain burn.
Yeah.
You know, because I think I'm kind of prone to that with War Machine of, oh, what am I doing with my focus? And oh, what does this guy do? And what hymn am I, is the choir singing? It's hard to keep in my head. So
So now that we have fully painted War Machine.
Well, no. What's your thought about that? That's kind of our joke when we finished the game was, oh, great. We really like this game. What are we going to do now? We've got these fully painted War Machine armies.
Right. Well, I'm certainly not going out and buying any 40K or selling my War Machine army. You know, I still want to play some more War Machine, but I'd also like to try some more 40K. And, you know, maybe down the line, you know, I would consider switching. And I know for me, I say switch because this is like the mother of all Jones Theory things. Like there's no way I can ever possibly think about supporting playing two collectible miniatures games because not only do you have the cost, you have the hobbying aspect, you have the storage, you have, you know, keeping the rule set separate. I could not fathom playing two, you know, I know the D6G guys, they play like 5-6 miniatures games.
Yeah.
One is good for me because my MO is with a miniatures game, I want to learn the rules and have them down cold, you know, so I just know it and there's less downtime.
Right.
So, you know, I want to play War Machine a lot, a good bit more, but there could be a switch down the line. We'll see.
See, for me, I think I probably would have room for two. And you know, and that's because they're very different. And I don't feel like I need to. It's for me, it's not like Magic, you know, think of, you know, another collectible sort of a deal is that with Magic, it's like the new thing comes out, you got to keep up with the new thing. You got to get the new deck, the new cards that do the new thing, and you know, keep up with that sort of, you know, keep up with the progress of the game. Whereas I feel like with War Machine, I have built a pretty nice 35 to 40 point Protectorate of Menoth army that I'm pretty happy with. Granted, if I look through the book and, you know, I could find some cool models that I would want to add to it, and I'm, you know, I've got a couple of mercenaries that I've added to it. But I'm pretty happy with that. That if someone said, "Hey, let's have a War Machine day," I could bring my army and I could play, you know, and I have everything that I need, and I don't feel dissatisfied with that because I don't play very often. So it's not like if I was playing War Machine every week for 3 months, I'd get sick of my army because I'd be like, "Yeah, I play this all the time," and I would be more compelled to buy new stuff. Whereas this game, I feel like War Machine, I feel like I can pull my army out once a month, play it, and enjoy it. With 40K, I think it's sort of the same thing, that if I were to build up a 1,500-point orc army, you know, because I like the orcs or whatever, you know, or pick your faction, and, you know, painted it up and had it ready to go, that when someone said, "Hey, you want to play some 40K, I can pull the 40K army out and play with it. And, you know, I don't see myself as turning into a play at the game store every week kind of a person. But I think having an army, a completed army on hand to be able to play when those times come up would not be a bad thing. So that's why I feel like I could do two, maybe even three miniatures games to that level, you know, to that level, but not beyond that. So
give me some money then.
Yeah, well, I mean, it takes time too. I'm not saying this would be, "Oh, I'm just going to go buy that tomorrow." But do you have any like try or deny? We kind of talked about buy points, but try or deny points for this game?
The entry cost is steep. You know, that's something you just have to consider. And the Assault on Black Reach, I have to say, it retails for 75.
75, yeah.
Yeah. That, I think you get a lot of value for that because you get pretty much a condensed version of the rule book. You get everything you need to play rules-wise. You
know, rule book, I meant to mention that. You get there's a large rule book that's like a giant hardcover behemoth.
Looks like an RPG book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's like a $50 book, something like that. It's got the rules, but it's got also all the fluff about the universe and things on the factions and stuff like that. And then when you buy the Assault on Black Reach set, you get this little paperback, kind of it's about 100-page.
It's like a digest size sort of thing.
Yeah, but it has all of the rules of the game. And I talked to a guy at the game store who said it's basically the rules section of the big book cleaved out and put into a smaller section. So you're getting all the rules. You're not losing anything.
You're not just getting a quick start thing.
Right.
You know?
It's the full deal.
And you get a good bit of models and all the templates and stuff you need. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty nice. But you just have to be aware that, you know, once you get into supplies and stuff, there will be some cost if you want to continue in it. So that's a try point. It's neither good nor bad. Just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Same for me. That's my main try point. It's a hobby game. If you're not interested in the hobby aspect of it, go to your game store and, you know, if someone's got an extra army that you could play with so you could try it out, do that first, you know. It worked out real good for us to have this Black Reach set that we could each check out, and you know, we were able to get it through a trade, but you know, proceed with caution. It's a hobby game.
Yeah. The only other thing is the theme could be off-putting. It's pretty dark stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
Just a word of warning there, and you're going to need a lot of dice.
A lot of dice,
which is not a bad thing. I like it, but no, it's pretty. You know, cool. Some people may not want to have a brick of dice with them to play.
Yeah.
Deny points.
Mm-hmm. None that I can really think of. I mean, the game's been around for almost 25 years. It's, you know, it's games that last that long usually don't have too many deny points.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the old guard can come up with deny points. I can't really think of any. You know, it's for me at the end of the day, I like War Machine. I like this. They're much more different than I thought they were.
Yeah.
Even though they still be Jones Theory for me, they play so much differently, and that really surprised me.
So if someone did want to get into this game, you know, what would they need to play? They, you know, the Black Reach set might be a good start.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you and a friend wanted to get started and play, or if you had a game store that you wanted to play at, you know, you could build a small army of just buying.
Yeah.
You know,
say you didn't want to do Space Marines and Orcs as the two factions.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's hopefully someone at your friendly professional game store could help you out, or online they're probably good, very entry level, you know, bait your bread and butter squads.
I think they even sell like a battle force set for each faction, so mm-hmm. which has a good number of models to get you started with that. So there's definitely the path to retail enlightenment from GW. You would need that. You would need dice. You would need the templates, paint, you know, a rule book of some sort if you don't go with the Black Reach set. You know, those would be something to store your models in would be, you know, would be a good idea. And the other thing is that there's the main rule book, but then if you play a particular faction, they have what are called the codices or the codex for each of the factions. And from what I hear, that's a really important book to have.
It's the equivalent of the deck of cards.
Yeah, right.
For War Machine.
It's going to have all of the updated rules because, I mean, and they update the codexes and modify the rules. That's the way that those things are updated. And so you'll want the most current codex for your army. But that would be what you need to get started. So, I mean, overall, I give this game, if I had to give it a buy, try, or deny rating, I'd give it a try. You know, I thought it was really good, but it's not going to be for everybody. It is a hobby game. But as the miniatures games go, it's really up there.
It's nice. I really enjoyed it.
Yep.
I sound so resigned.
Oh, so yeah. Good.
Yeah. Really liked it. Dang
well,
it.
We'll play again, right?
Definitely.
All right. Well, are we ready to close out the show?
I say we do it.
Let's do it. No denying, I'm ineffective. You suckers are trying to get with me. You can't hang. Doing it like this, I'm in with the bang. Going boom like thunder, and you wonder how in the world could the hammer be underneath me? He's gonna beat me. Say yes to the master, and I'm gonna DC.
Well, we hope that's the end to another successful episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Yep.
Wayne's going to tell you all the good stuff on the way out, but we just want to thank everyone who entered our Dragon Age RPG contest.
Yes.
And congratulations to Corey Gerleman for winning that.
Yep. And we'll have another contest probably in our next episode. I'm going to be going to, actually by the time this episode comes out, I will have already come back, but going to Board Game Geek Con in Dallas and hope to maybe pick up some of the new hotness from Essen, possibly, and some of the other things that are going on there. So I'm sure that we'll be able to pull out a contest item of some sort for the next show. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, our prize pile is accumulating things very quickly. So
it is. And the more I cull out my game collection, that prize pile might grow leaps and bounds. You know?
John's loss could be your game.
Could be, yeah. So anyway, we've got lots of great other gaming stuff coming up for you in the next episode. So until then,
game on.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
So we have one more email that we'd like to read for you, and that is from, once again, my phone is failing me.
Well,
not surprising.
A softball. I'm not even going to swing at that one.
Okay, and it's continuing to fail me.
This is great radio.
I know, it's terrible.
This will be edited out.